Well, welcome everybody. This is an hour of poetry reading by villagers. My name is David Wee, and I'm here just as an introducer. I don't have to moderate much, but I thought that it would be good to have a brief introduction. We have six people who will read poetry this evening, and I think that this is the order in which we'll have them do it. Christina Granberg, Janice Hawkins, Allison Schuett, Margaret Lovejoy, Jan Bowman, and Karen Herseth Wee, the latter two of whom are up here. I've been to many poetry readings during my career as a college English professor, and one of my favorite brief little poems is a poem about a visiting poet. It's a little two-line poem by X.J. Kennedy entitled Visiting Poet. And while the poets tonight are not visiting, we're all residents here for a while, I'd like to recite this little two-line poem because I think it characterizes much of the kind of poetry and the kind of poets that historically have been on the circuit doing poetry readings in our country. I think I have it committed to memory. Visiting Poet by X.J. Kennedy. The famous poet comes. He nears. He nears. May God protect your wife, your booze, your ears. Well, I thought of that because I think the poets we're going to hear tonight are such a sharp contrast to that whole image. So while I was out running yesterday, I composed an alternate couplet, a kind of heroic couplet to introduce tonight's poets that I think captures the tone of what I expect to hear a little bit better. In words, their strength and wisdom sparkle clear to feed the hungry soul and please the ear.
Pope would be very proud.
Alexander Pope would have been proud of that. So I'll just turn this over now to the poets and invite each one of you to say whatever you'd like in introducing the poems that you're going to read to us.
And Christina, why don't you come over here? The mic picks up very well, but it's nice to be close to it.
This is a poem written by my great great grandma by the name of Sarah Ada Hibbard Richards.
What else do you know about her? Where did she live?
She was born in, I think, West Virginia, and then brought up in Ohio. And she lived from 1854 to 1898. The poem is called George Washington and was memorized by Ada's children. George had a birthday many years ago, so long we've all forgotten, but Grandma tells us so. His father had a cherry tree which tempted George much, from which he'd often warn him with hatchet not to touch. But when his father went to work upon a summer day, poor George took the hatchet and cut the bark away. No doubt his father paddled him, as yours would do today, which taught him his son a lesson, with hatchet not to play.
Oh, do another one. Do another one.
Sure.
The next poem is called An Empty Vase and was written for Lenny Breckenridge and presented with An Empty Vase by Ada. An empty vase I seem to be, but I'm full to the brim with wishes for thee. You look in my depths and fail to see the precious thoughts I bear to thee. And I could smile with your view my face and thank the donor with modest grace. For well I know, though empty I seem, the dearest gift is all unseen.
Thank you.
Wonderful book to have. Christina said there are a few copies.
Janice?
This poem is called Inner Child. I catch glimpses of you in your struggle to be free. Free to experience all that surrounds you, absorbed in wonder and awe, trapped beneath this pain. O joyous one, delight to my heart, how I long for your company to ease the burden of my soul. Come, teach me once again, uninhibited, to dance.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Allison?
This is not my poem, although I'd like to take credit for it. This is by Mike Chaucer, a friend of mine from Valparaiso, who just graduated as well, and is now a highly frustrated English major. And so this came out of that frustration. It's called, In Defense of the Marginally Marketable and Hitherto Unemployed or Underpaid English Major. We recognize the major that leaves us unemployed. Like sighs, we page through applications and rejections, employment opportunities and connections, reading fine print like poetry, thumbing through the telephone directory and yellow pages, hoping to discover the crucial sign or symbol, the narrative technique to lead us on and to employment. We somehow knew, our parents, teachers, friends informed us early on, that we were not in high demand these days, but something made us do it. Something made us give away our hopes of engineering, a worldly connotation of security. Our wallets empty, our hands are busy turning pages, our minds, like shelves, are full of everything we've read. And in the end, were the choice to come again, we'd choose the art we choose each day. That reading, writing will remain when every job in government has shriveled up and blown away.
It's kind of strange to come here and sit down like this. Well, this one is one that I wrote, and it's just a play with words. In. In the beginning, in the middle, in the end. In the system, in the crowd, in the no, in the bank, in the red, in the green, in the black, insufficient, in depth, inept, in gratitude, in power, in house, in here, in the beginning, in the middle, in the end. In love, in tune, in formed, in tears, in silence, in rage, in keeping, in firm, in tiered, in war, in peace, in season, in the beginning, in the middle, in the end. In kind, in God, in keeping, in prayer, in church, in death, in memory, in the beginning, in the middle, in the end. Then this one is, it was a time of one of my rebirths, I guess, of fighting the battle and sometimes losing and coming back again. It's entitled The Phoenix. The phoenix, bird of renewal, is rising from ashes of experience. Triumphant bird lifts her wings, wind gusts push her back. Wispy tidbits of breezes persuade her to raise her chin, lifting her eyes to the possibilities of what can be. Eyes that were matted, cracked, and swollen with burning debris regain the sharp clearness from what was. They open wide, cast off all dullness, emblazon to see around, above, under, and through the pile from which she must emerge. Her nostrils flare and fill with the now of today. The smoky past of unfiltered air is pushed out, replaced with newly born spring breezes. The lift, the beautiful, energizing lift. The wings lose all that was timid and insecure. They stretch out, her head held high. Back is arched to the point of near breaking. Ashes are flung back to earth, scattered in disarray. Flicking her feathers, free of them, she casts behind the remnants of their acrid presence. And on a whisper, the phoenix rises, ascending into flight. Well, this one came up, so. This one is The Dancer Within, and it was one of my really early poems that I wrote. I started writing probably 10 years ago. Yeah, 10 years ago. It's The Dancer Within. Inside of me is a dancer, beating and tapping out the rhythm of life, moving slowly, swaying, twirling around and around, leaping, jumping, bounding, always trying to get higher, dancing for fun, dancing for sorrow, always trying to teach the dance. Please be my partner, come dance with me, join in the beat. The beat is the sound of my heart, the in and out pushing of my lungs, the movement of my shoulders, the snapping of my fingers. The rhythm is my step, my gait, my bounce, my being. Inside of me is a dancer longing to leap free.
Thank you.
Yes.
Will you read Woman, Sister, Friend?
Mm-hmm. Woman, Sister, Friend. You like that one?
Mm-hmm.
This winter, Megan put all of my poetry onto a disc so I can go in and edit it now. And it's wonderful. Which I've edited, but this is the way it was first written. Woman, sister, friend. We've got it in us, my woman, sister, friend. We've got the power to be just what we want to be. Come along, my woman, sister, friend. Stay together, show them how powerful we can really be. We've got it inside us, my woman, sister, friend, and no one can take it away, not from you or me or her. We've struggled a long time and we'll make it, walking along the path that's been walked on before. We'll have to walk over the backs of other women and sisters and friends, but that's the reason they made the path, so we could find the way. Don't be afraid, we've got it together, my woman, sister, friend.
Thank you. I wrote my first poem when I was a senior in college, and then I didn't write for another 12 years or so. And at that time, I wrote a few poems, but didn't really stay with it, and then just returned to writing poetry a couple of years ago. The occasion was the death of my parents. And as Ivan Doig said in This House of Sky, the death of a parent splits the tongue of silence. And he's referring to all of those memories which emerge with new meaning when your parents are gone. I wasn't prepared for this, the rushing in of memory, some of them very good and others not so good. The other subject that is a part of the poems that I'll read for you were some dreams that I had, both after my father's death and before my mother's death. I guess psychologists call these dreams precognitive. I think that's an odd label, but what it means is that in a way they are prophetic. They are announcing the death of a loved one. So two of the poems are based on dreams about my parents' death. The first one's called The Reptile Farm. When we were little girls, my father had us pose for pictures in exotic places, looking like twins in matching shorts or dresses, hers pink or red, mine always blue. My sister's ringlets hung obediently around her apple cheeks, but my own fluff was lifted in waves from unseen winds and races. On car trips through the Rockies, mountains spoke to Dad, requiring a sacrifice of sorts. His virgin daughters stuck out on some lofty limb or rock, 1,000 feet of air for prayer, or backed up to the grandest canyon's rim. Our little smiles so new against the reddish blue of ancient deeds, one push and gods would rub their needs away. He was a sporting man, guns, grizzlies, trout and tackle, daughters too. Not far from Sarasota, where we wintered, he spotted a reptile farm, a tourist zoo, brightly flanked by billboards, red and blue. His movie camera ready, his pride high, he ordered my sister and me to take a ride on a real live crocodile. We knew Jungle Joe was wrong, God help us, silly girls. We sat on the animal's thorny back, our tender thighs just the size for him. He slept, he moved, he snapped. Head rolled on a powerful neck and jaws like lightning cracked. My sister's arm leapt from the jagged scissors with a scream. Run, oh run, little girls, the gates are closing fast, and safety lies somewhere, neither present nor past. I think everyone can identify with the picture taking in that poem, because we've all been asked to back up against some scenic spot, and sometimes we remember the terror of hanging over a cliff. I've also talked to people who actually remember going to a reptile farm in Florida about the same era.
Yeah, like Gatorland?
I imagine it's very similar.
Jungle Joe.
Jungle Joe, right. This poem is one that's based upon a dream that I had, and it's called Many Mansions. It refers to the passage in the Gospel of John about, I go to prepare a place for you. Father, you are tired, very tired, and longing for home, your face drawn down by burdens and blinds to darkness so deep you almost seem dead. Your voice is gone. No murmurings about fickle brothers now, no rehearsing their wrongs, no bad business thrumming your head, nor dealings with preachers a plague on your heart, their hardy youth a thorn in your sagging breast. No, you are leaving all that now, and sailing the ocean, it seems, not like the one you sailed as a child, alone and far from home, your parents behind you, your brothers ahead. Not like that sea, that wild, stormy sea, which lifted you on a violent swell from kicks and curses to crude barnyard hell. You are sailing for a far-off shore, another shore you've never seen. Beyond the vast curtains of darkness, my sister prepares a place for you, a place luxurious and green, where plants fed by emerald seas grow vast as stars and warmly gleam. She is setting a table for your long ease. Her arms bear an offering of ocean trees and mollusks whose crenulated shells hold secrets sweet, like pear trees in spring, unfurling before you their white petal froth. She invites you to eat. Your heart is not troubled with sighs. The rooms here are spacious and glowing with surprise. Another ship is setting sail. I hear her rustling, bustling about. Call her on home. She is packing up and moving on out. The next poem is one that I read in a session called Cries of the Spirit, Contemporary Women Poets, and I included it along with a poem by Marge Piercy entitled Unlearning to Not Speak. It concerns silences. Dangerous acts of an ordinary kind. I know the terror of common things, like ending a sentence I've begun when the meaning drops off in the middle. A victim of the precipice my brain has become, that grand canyon of possibilities for disaster of the ordinary kind. Or worse yet, the dangerous act of speaking up or shouting out, I disagree. Imagine the ruckus that would cause, a bottle smashing riot in my brain, and my heart would pound the pavement to escape before the cops. Oh my God, the cops came, their sirens screaming out my name.
You didn't say that was a faculty meeting.
Oh, yes. I wrote this after an English department meeting. In which I was afraid to disagree with the chair of the department. I just noticed that the Grand Canyon figures into a couple of these poems. It must be a very meaningful image for me. I first visited it when I was about 7 years old. Okay, and my last poem is called The Shining of All Griefs, and is another poem based upon a dream that I had concerning my father. He sat bathed in the shining light with his back to the door. We in the family circle were still, waiting for the shining to speak. It touched him on the shoulders of his blue jacket, and from the soft waves of white hair it shimmered. He was old, but the light lifted years and silvered the lines of his face. My mother was the first to move. She glided around our shadowy shapes and walked past him into the light. He was the life and the death of her, yet neither one spoke what they knew. Suddenly his head fell into his hands and he sobbed with a groan that shook us. Children, he said, wiping his sorrow with bare hands, let the children come to me. I rose first and slipped to his side. Father, I said, stroking the light of his face, and the shining of all griefs filled the room. Karen, beautiful. It's your
Thanks,
turn.
Jill. I'm Karen Herseth Wee. And one of the pleasures of coming to Holden this time is that I got to bring a new object with me, which was this book. It wasn't even done when we got on the Amtrak train to come, so it got shipped after we were here. And it's fun to see it. I've not had a book alone by myself before. And so tonight I'll read some pieces from that. But first I wanted to read you something that I wrote here last summer. There had been a physicist in the village named Joe Jordan. Maybe you know him. And he had explained to us how we were all made of stars. And he and my mother had been talking one night, and he took her on a star. She couldn't do the more rugged kind of strenuous walks, and so he did a special evening with her once talking about stars. Of 92, that we are all made of stars. That billions of years ago the atoms burst when stars exploded and floated through the time and galaxies and stratospheres into Earth's atmosphere, then entered a thunderstorm that hit Northfield the week before we left for Holden Village in September of 1979, when I walked home in that downpour to pack away the last boxes for our renters before a six-month sabbatical at Holden, drenching my hair to the skull. So the star you saw above Martin's Ridge that night in 79, as I trekked the hike of my life with Dan Erlander and Laura and Andy, might have been me. My mind's eye, born of stars, lit like a lighthouse, a beacon, right at the spot on Martin's Ridge where the mountain shoots down each side, leaving a 12-inch shelf where I humbly, and no small bit frightened, lower myself to my knees and crawl over to the next mountain. It's also called going from age 39 to 40. That's the age I was when I did that Martin Ridge hike, and I haven't done it since. And this little book is divided into four sections. The first section, some of you who were here in the village at the night that David and I did Vespers have heard some of those. It's the coming out section of our journey of parenting a lesbian daughter. The second section has to do with my background in South Dakota. I grew up on a ranch where some of the land still has never been tilled, and though I've lived longer in Minnesota than I did there, I'm imprinted and cannot get that background and that landscape out of myself. I'm not whole unless I go home a couple times a year. The third section, it has more odd things in it. Things I just like. Some love poetry, some kind of strange things. The last section has to do with the end of things. It's not meant to be terribly depressing, but it also is quite specifically menopausal kind of stuff. I think a lot of the secrecy around gay-lesbian issues is only surmounted with the secrecy around menopausal kinds of things. So I wanted to put it all in one book. This first one that I'll read is called Omen. It was not good luck last night to find a real chewed on rabbit's foot on the bedroom floor. But an omen of this time in life for me, I picture the rabbit out there somewhere, huddled beneath a bush, screaming silently as rabbits can. Or maybe it's just hunks of fur cast far abreast the carcass, camouflaged babies somewhere, hiding in the grass. My birthright set of years has half wound down, the children's choices, ones I would not choose. A spirit in the wind bodes ill this spring, for near Alaskan shores, birds plunge in oil leaking from an Exxon tanker. Feathers clog and part, the cold creeps in. Even Arctic birds cannot survive the poison licking at the flanks of land. My blood slows down, arms and legs begin to feel it first, that age-old glacial truth that cannot take the heat of years, but drips an unseen melt of blood in deep climactic change. Outside, the dog still waits for me to toss the foot to her. Bones become dust, yet skin drapes them. Friends notice, but the real crumbles invisible, like a mind leaving a crime scene. This body changed before my eyes, and I was helpless to stop it. Young, I had thought I was in charge, could will myself tall, slim, almost happy. But the body had other ideas, lowered its center of gravity from the head to the belly, preparing for I don't know what. Although the bones talk among themselves, mostly at night, and I dream in their language, come morning I cannot recall dialect, inflection, especially meaning. I am 50 for 3 days now, and today comes a letter in my mother's hand. She's remembering and tells me of that remembering, how on the day that I was born, I was stubborn and did not want to leave her, the warm pouch, how I did not yet care about the outside wonders. She tells me how, inexperienced and uninformed, she learned to push alone. And at 10 p.m. on a Saturday in 1940, she gathered her whole blood from the source and pushed me out into the light, so that today, a half century later, I can read aloud a poem from a daughter in Washington, D.C. And last night heard a song coming down the centuries on my other daughter's tongue, a seer echoing her sister, Mama, I am coming home. Leaving taught me how absurd it is to think that we can ever leave. An oriental fan of cherry blossoms arrives from my son in Japan. I think of him there, how he writes on the fan that he wants to hear my voice. I know what he means because just last Sunday I walked to church, nearly singing aloud because my mother and I had talked an hour on the phone of family things close to the bone, to hers, to mine, and flesh of her flesh. I was warm and walking, almost singing, my heart throbbing its regular beat with the odd click I've been told that sometimes mothers hand down to daughters. I think to myself, I should remember to tell them. Tell them it's perfectly natural. Tell them not to be alarmed when they are told of the click, the heart's wonder that I too hand down. Death can come as you sit in a cafe quietly talking. It can lie on its side, blending in, and slip down your throat with the ease of a pin baked into French bread. when it falls from the upstanding collar of a busy shopkeeper up at 5 a.m. rolling out dough on a sideboard. She hurriedly fastens a blouse with it where a button's dropped off. But refusing the task, the pin falls to the dough toward a destiny beyond itself till it is lifted up in clenched amazement between the forefinger and thumb of a chewing, visiting woman who struck something firm between her molars, hesitated, almost swallowed, kept talking and chewing the bread with her friend in the cafe. She places the pin on a serving tray like a scalpel and gravely shows the proprietress. It lies there innocent, awaiting the next hand that will put it to use. That actually happened. Have you ever waked up on a spring morning and all the worms are out and there's that particular smell in the air? The smell of silence? Silence, no answers on the wind. I walk the early morning highway and smell the worms, for in the night it rained and a million earthworms wrenched their thick, soft bodies up from depths of dirt to crawl across the land and die before the tires of cars or bake in the sun. Their silver tracks still glisten, then stop abruptly in lumps of flesh. Their silent protests smashed like mine. I breathe in their silent smell. Ask why such desperate surfacing, such deliberate death. Is this why doves still mourn a summer dawn? Or why a distant startled rooster pheasant squawks? Somewhere, someone's human bomb has dropped, no global flash, no stormy wind of fire, just the smell of silence. Fable. Now it came to pass that she was only three, a golden apple-eating child, yet she could stamp her feet and claim an old authority. Daddy, Daddy, tell me, who's the fairest in the land? You are, he'd say, you are. Then be the handsome prince and wake me, Daddy, wake me now, he'd smile. And with a kiss, he would. On a Victorian chaise, she'd lie straight out, purse her tiny lips, tight shut her eyes, and he, on bended knee, would kiss her cheek. She'd wake in glee and spit a piece of apple out. Then, Mommy, Mommy, dearest, you be the wicked queen. Please, please, you be the wicked queen. And she, unthinking, would don a grim and cruel face and cry, Come, come and eat, my daughter dearest. Eat this large red apple, the likes of which you've never seen. Come eat my large red apple. The child would, and feign a weakness, stagger toward the chaise and wail, Daddy, Daddy, be the handsome prince and save me. Wake me, Daddy, please. Again the kiss, the likes of which she would not feel again for years. For it came to pass that on a visit of the mother's mother, as she watched this ancient rite replayed the 100th time, she said, Daughter, daughter, you know not what you do, the wicked queen indeed. Stop, daughter, stop this poison game. And once upon a time, they did. This one I stole a line from Linda Hogan, a Native American writer whom I admire a great deal. Her poem is The History of Fire. Her book is The History of Fire, and the poem is Savings, and the first line is, I am smoke with gray hair. And if you ever want to take off and write a poem of your own, steal a line from somebody and then see where it goes. I am smoke with gray hair, a will-o'-the-wisp who lit in your life with more will than I ever let on. We tell a story in our family of how you pursued me, how I declined time and time again in that first year, but even then I was smoke, and you were the air I would live in. Who knows where the spirit came from, out of which woods or which field, over which water. Anyway, the wind picked up, fanned the flame, and now sometimes a prairie fire rages. But you, smart like those old pioneers, always emerge from the sod hut you built to save us long ago in that very first year. We've always had a family tension about David's fanaticism with running, so things like that crop up once in a while. Here's a kind of odd one called Running to You. Would I were running to you. The high and smile and strength you know on country roads in company eludes us now. The years stretch taut from that June day in Aberdeen to three children, dogs, cats, the white mice later. Your body tan the year round, glints beaded sweat, I always look. Recall your touch, my fingers sliding on those muscles hard from running country roads. You pass abandoned barns and houses falling down where ordinary lives were spent. Now just the splintered walls recall as sparrows dart in and out an upstairs bathroom window, strings of hay or barley beards from last year's stubble dangling in their beaks. And in one yard, an empty well, its broken windmill props in need of mending before the wind can spin me. Would I were running to you, your eyes mine and new. And this poem is probably the oldest one in this book, and I wrote it here in 79 after an argument with a friend about the word feminism. Not even the concept yet, but the word. I'm fascinated with words and can write poems just because I like a particular word, like aubergine or feminism. And this one is fairly didactic. Upon thinking about the word feminism, I rest my front teeth gently on my bottom lip and start into a quiet hum, both lips together. When a half smile separates the hum, the word is born. Feminism. And it is good. I name it good. It tastes of sisters, camaraderie, knowing men as friends. It sports the new mint side of an Anthony coin. No one's small change, but round, real, found at last, the long-lost widow's mite. Good, it does not usurp, but reveals epiphanies, awakens men with as gentle nudges as sisters give each other to centers of a different order, different rhythms. I call it good, like kisses dreamt. Good, it grinds down competition's hard-edged sound into a cabochon, new kind of cameo that releases women's faces from that pink and thankless quest for youth which claims the lines around their mouths for lack of smiling's sake. Young girls could learn to like each other, share lollipops and boys, and teach the boys that all the words for ineffectual are not female. The boys would listen, learn to know that it was good, this new created order, this new meaning. In country homes and cities, a new self-image could emerge, would sustain two fragile egos in one shared space, each in need of nurturing, share chores and love. They would not wish for sons when birthing daughters. The word is good in its true self. What we have understood is not. From that fallow ground, we'll reap the wind, weeds of anger, hate men, and teach our children what the word is not. Such meager chickweed will not sustain the masses. Is not, therein lies the key. We are what men are not. I call it good to grow in pride of what we're proudly not. Share the birthing of this pride. Claim our newborn far from ugly babe, midwife us, name it good, and we will parent generations of a different rhythm, not mutually exclusive, but of a different motion that may not allow much time to polish wingtip shoes or pack someone else's bags for business trips. I grew up riding horseback and loved it, and really haven't had a horse in my life since I met academia and got married and have lived in town ever since. My father died when I was 29, and he's had a huge effect in my life, which if I ever go into therapy, I will enjoy finding out about, but I haven't done that yet. This is called Horse. And it has a date in it, January 24th, which is the date my father died. Horse. From 24 December to January 24, each day hangs opaquely toward earth. A horse from the past steps out of a foggy landscape as I drive to the cities, calling on the memory of horse. Bessie, Gray Lady, Dandery, the black one I never named. I remember the spirited sound, the hooves, the ice trip on this road to the airport at my father's dying, the dark, snaking, hearse-led line of cars through snow. The creature horse in my head, our source and connected skin, a deep memory, language resonating from the withers. That black horse, carrier of more than spirit but nothing less, lived briefly on the land of my youth. My brother found it dead in a corn stubble field, kept from food by the others. 15 years later, I know it as a sign. Horsepower. Round of belly, great in shoulder, aging, I have come to look like horse. It has little to do with a fast way out. Already I have lived long at the edge, neither in nor out of town. My piece of grass too small for horse or self. Once many horses, Angus too, ran in my father's fields. I thought my inheritance contained them. Then I married, traveled, birthed babies, learned I left more than horse behind. A pinto appears on the skyline. Its black-white arrangement of skin moves close to the freeway. I leave the car. It will not come, won't put its nostrils or remembered breath into my palm. But someday the lost, unnamed one will reappear and prophesy. Till then I search the winter prairie, roadways, the far pastures. Always there are fences. Fence lines and fields of grain within, corn, oats, wheat, rye, seldom flax. But when there's flax behind a fence, the whole world comes blue, as though I lived on a seacoast somewhere. Our fences ended at a lake which kept our ranch from falling off the spinning planet. Without that lake there, Grandpa would have just kept on reeling land in. Only deer and trains cross against the fence lines. I raced a train once, dawdled on my horse between a barbed wire fence and the railroad tracks. The steel one rose up suddenly beside me, spooked my horse, and raced us toward the horizon. Each time I'm home, I take a pickup truck and skirt the lake just to look back down fence lines. In summer, I can sight down them like a surveyor, straight into the old days, and in any blizzarding winter, I can follow one, even barbed wire, seldom noticing the ones that still keep me in. The heart of the matter. Our farm home is an old home that I will describe in this poem, built in 1908, that has lots of oak in it. I don't know how Grandpa got the work people there or the building materials, because it was a long ways from any city. But it's a magnificent house, and I realize that in all my life I don't like to be in houses with low ceilings because this house doesn't have, and that is what feels good to me. This house, raised against all odds on the east side of Sand Lake in South Dakota, 1908, rebuilt itself in my heart. In the years after I was 20, I moved fast, moved 8 different times in fewer years, unaware that builders had been contracted and were already at work on the monumental task in my heart's space, oak banisters and all. 17 individually carved dowels to the landing, 27 more to the second floor. The bottom pillar with a loose lid, where us kids dropped a German oak nutcracker one holiday. We didn't tell. He lay in there years. Later I searched for him with a flashlight, but he had gone, and I do not know his rescuer. No other truly grand houses line Sand Lake, the kind with carved lintels above each downstairs window and sliding oak doors between the two largest rooms. But not even such a house could save Grandma Herseth from herself, her own dark interior, as Grandpa's large laugh resounded through its rooms after he'd bet on horses or drunk himself into a stupor in distant towns. This house's attic, in my heart, allows such a view of distance that to this day hills or too many tall trees closet me. Each spring, the pull on my body home foreshadows the day my heart falls down, the great-grandfather clock finally quiet in the heart's room. A refinished bookcase, cum desk, held cattle medicine in my young dad helping days. The dining room still contains a carved table and buffet and 8 chairs that my mother bought for $74.88 when she was very young, before her marriage even. My luck to be brought to this house in 1940, a newborn. I know its intimacies, every depth of corner. I can move in its dark without sound, my hand finding light switches or landing places before my head does. The women who come to this house to live with the men who own it do not know their way here as my sister and I do, and we banished ones resent those who later offer civilly to please feel at home. All the rest of the years that they live in this house, they will never carry its great weight in such a small place as a heart. And I think I'll end with this one called Cut. I love original earth, like the pasture at home in Dakota that's never been plowed. Its curves reveal the circular shadows of Indian encampments, and pasque flowers, faint feathery blue with saffron stamens reaching like feelers. I remember my Mustang's hooves crushing them, yet the pasques return spring after spring. They push up baked clay, yet tied to the earth's apron. Each year since then, the land's curves harbor pheasant nest secrets, the broken shells of my memory of mowing the blowing grasses. How in the last round I would leap off the tractor to run through the narrow swath of still-standing brome, to chase out the small furred and feathered before finally thrusting that sickle through. Dad wondered what always took me so long on that last round, and I never told him. I wish I had, but I had not yet learned what we had in common, the prairie in our veins like blood. Maybe if we'd each sliced a wrist and held them tightly to each other, both of us would have been more grounded. Maybe everything else would have been different. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions? I'll give you a line to start your next poem. You can either do it tonight or tomorrow morning, bright and early, before you have muddled your head up with other things. Have your first line be, "To be here today, I left behind." Da 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 da. "To be here tonight, I left behind." And you can have it be the big things in your life or the small things. It could be in your room if you wanted it to be. But "to be here today, I left behind." And if anything happens, show it to me. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks to all
the readers.